Ellie Flippin, my guest, and she is Ingo Swann's niece. The book, Stardust Highways, includes his artwork.
So The Lightbringer was his last painting, and it's on display at the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore. He says that an entity dictated to him, so he's doing a portrait of an entity that came to him and said, this image, and was very concerned with the details, Ingo says, and said that he get all the details right, and that's how he says that painting came to be. But I think he worked on it over the course of at least 5 to 6 years.
This is a wonderful gift because he didn't want his work, you know, like postcards and posters and stuff like that. He wanted people to see it in person. So when you have the book, technically you're seeing it in person. These things aren't accessible, or, you know, if they are, they're rare and you have to travel. But right now you can have Ingo's artwork, and it's just absolutely extraordinary. People have referred to Ingo as a visionary, and I see that in his art. So Ellie, I am so glad. Now, you also threw some more things in, like recipes and food. And so there's something for everybody in terms of the background with Ingo, his dining, and some of his experiences that he remembers being a kid and having his experience in Telluride. So there's just so much more in this book that's beyond the other books that he's put out himself. So you've done, a wonderful service for people who would like to know more about Ingo Swann. Thank you.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you. I mean, this book is a celebration of Ingo. It's meant to be that way and to really showcase the human side, if you will, to Ingo, because so many people look him as the father of remote viewing and the super psychic and the psychic spy. And of course, his art is, to him, was very personal. And although you can see it in museums around the country, most of it's in private collections. They were his children to him. They weren't a mechanism for him to be selling these. I mean, certainly early on when he came to New York and he wanted to be an artist, he sold them so that he could make a living. But for him, they were an expression of the potentials within all of us. And so wanted to be able to share this other side, this rarely seen side of Ingo, the artist, the explorer of human potentials through his art. And of course, Ingo as host and chef extraordinaire.
And you were long for part of this. The remote viewing, I remembered something about you actually being there with him when he was doing remote viewing of Mars. Is that accurate, or have I embellished?
Well, when he met Bob Durant, and Bob Durant came when Jim Schnabel was writing his book on remote viewers, and so he trained Jim Schnabel at the same time that he trained Bob Durant. Bob Durant was sort of a guy, Delta or Transamerica, regardless, a commercial airline pilot, very interested in remote viewing. I believe had some experiences with UFOs. So it was really kind of on the UFO angle. And once he trained Bob and Jim together, Jim went on his way, wrote his book, but Bob stayed with Ingo and they became really close friends. You see Bob's picture in this book here. And they worked on a number of side projects together, along with Paula Roberts, who Ingo met in the mid-90s as well. She came to do, there were some unexplained phenomena happening within the building. Charlie House, who had been an astrologer, pretty well-known in sort of the underground astrology spiritual church movement in New York, he actually passed away on the third floor, and subsequently there were always these kind of strange, I want to say not necessarily evil, but not necessarily nice things happening in the building. So Paula Roberts at that time was sort of a ghost hunter, and she was recommended to Ingo, and she came and to do some sort of ghost hunting in 357, and they ended up being really close friends. So with Paula and Bob Durant, Ingo did a number of these kind of side projects, which included remote viewing Mars, the pyramids in Egypt, and a number of kind of like outer space and past history stuff on Earth.
Recently, there has been one more little clue, hint dropped that they found water on Mars. Water on the moon, I'm sorry.
Water on the moon, yes. And of course, you know, Ingo talks about that at great length in his book, Penetration. And he talks about those in the past who've actually brought this forward. And, of course, they were ridiculed and laughed at and discredited. But he devotes quite a bit of at least one section of his book on penetration to that very thing.
Yeah, he was ahead of his time. And the things that he saw, people couldn't fathom how he could do what he did. And I think it's still, he's an enigma. But he's very adamant that we haven't even touched the tip of the iceberg on our own psi abilities, PSI abilities, that this is something that everybody has access to. It's a matter of training and also allowing people to believe that, because it's still ridiculed in a lot of circles.
Oh, absolutely. And for a long time, right, the remote viewing community and the UFO community were fairly divergent. I think what we're seeing is they're coming back together again, which is great, because I think in some respects they go hand in hand, right? The people, certainly in the mid-80s, remote viewers, even with the Stargate program, were tasked with seeing other planets, were tasked with seeing Mars, were tasked with seeing UFOs and things like that. We probably don't know everything and probably will never know everything because it's still classified, but it certainly was something of great interest to the U.S. government.
Well, what I think is fascinating is there is so much that is still classified. I mean, there are some bombshells that have been released in terms of his abilities and what he saw, and yet there's still that much more that we don't have access to. In Penetration, I think he wrote about being taken to an undisclosed location, and then they did some certain procedures, and then something appeared in the sky and scared him to pieces. And then they ask him, okay, so what was your sense of that? And he said, next time, give me a warning before you want to know that, okay? Don't frighten me to death and ask me to tell you what sense I got. That was my favorite part of the book. Okay, so basically, you know, dumping somebody into the pool and asking him to swim, and it's full of sharks, and then asking him how it felt. Okay, right. No win. The book is Stardust Highways. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say it was sort of like he was tasked once to see a submarine, and he said he was much more interested in seeing the UFO that was hovering over the submarine than the submarine itself.
Oh yeah, by the way, what about this? Yeah, okay, well, and you're not interested, cool, all right, that wasn't on my list of things to do, so I won't report it, just strike that from the record. Okay, Stardust Highways, Ingo Swann's Art of Entertaining. There's some fun recipes in here, too. Okay, so you said you had to go back and kind of recreate some of the recipes. Do you have a favorite that you're, you know, some of a section? And there's anything from the cucumbers that are in there to the different types of alcoholic drink mixes that he has, like three alcohols. That's what he told you, three alcohols, and that's it. Then you had to come up with, okay, yeah. Which three?
Which three? And I believe he told me, but I was just out of college. I was in my mid to late 20s. This is, of course, before there were video cameras or your phone where you could record everything. And yeah. I paid attention, but not to the level that I should have. I only just remembered it was three alcohols. And there's always, I'm like, well, okay, well, how crazy is this? And that's really what drove me to do this book, right? So people were always asking, hey, couldn't we create some lithographs or some sort of special high-end print of his art? And Ingo never wanted that. And I think I talk about, like, I am not going to go against Ingo. Even if he's passed away, I still think there are ways that with energies and forces that could have effects. And so I'm not going to challenge that. I'm just going to stay true to what Ingo wanted, which was, I want it to be experienced in person. They don't want to have things on mugs and postcards, as you said, or right. prints. And anytime anyone has tried, it's never really worked out. Well, so I thought, okay, well, here's, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, he even had difficulty when he was trying to sell his art to start out with. He had an exhibition, and it bombed, and so he put everything in a bag out on the street, then walked out to find somebody had picked up the bag, made their own use of it, and was selling it. It's like hotcakes. He's like, okay, apparently it's not going right. to work for me.
It's not. And he talks about having to do his own exhibits, paying for his own exhibitions, things like that. So it was pretty much word of mouth is how he sold his art. But I'll tell you, I think he made his living as, you know, those sex books, those party book writers. That's really where he kind of made his living, as well as working at the UN. It was kind
okay.
of his side.
Okay. So, yeah. This is worth talking about. I had a teacher in college who also used a fake name, wrote for Playboy and wrote other stuff like that, Penthouse. And here's a college teacher, and that's his kind of his, you know, down on the down low. But everybody knew behind the scenes, oh, that's the teacher who writes for those magazines. Okay. Ingo not only wrote, he did art. And what's this thing about the mafia where he had a little meeting and,
Yes. So he would tell me, so you know, he had these three books, published under two different names with Olympia Press, which was like, the story of O and Lolita. So, I mean, they were pretty avant-garde, publishers of this kind of material. But before that, he told me that he would write these kind of whatever pornographic stories and meet up with his mafia contact in some dive bar, and he'd slide the manuscript to them, and they'd slide a little envelope of cash toward them. So I think he had quite a little side business going on.
Okay, you know, just you know, because it's helpful to know all of the bits and pieces about the guy that helped make him the person he is, because he's still an enigma. The things that he was able to do, I like the stories about. One, when he was a kid and he was in fifth grade, used to climb rock climbing in Telluride. That's an amazing story. You want to share that?
Yeah. So that story I came across because it was in his files. He never really talked about it, but I guess he did share it for this publication, and it's his angel story. So I guess, you know, Telluride is, and you can sort of see in the, have two photographs from the Telluride Historical Museum to kind of get a sense of here's the town and then these huge peaks right behind Main Street. So he and his friend Eddie, who I guess would go climbing up in the hills in places they shouldn't go because you never knew when something was going to give way. It was not really like a carved out path that you would see in hiking, but really subject to landslides or rock slides. And I guess, in one day, he didn't go with his friend Eddie, but Eddie went up, and Eddie never came back. They found him, Ingo says, at the bottom of the canyon. Obviously, something had happened, and he slipped, fell, rocks gave way, whatever, tumbled down the mountain, and bloodied and bruised. And that, seeing Eddie in that state, was highly traumatic for Ingo. And he was deathly afraid of the mountain. I mean, he says the school is pretty close to the hillside. He was very afraid to even look up at the mountain. And as a child, right, so he's like in fifth grade, he had this tremendous fear because of what happened to his friend. And one day he said, I'm just not going to be afraid anymore. I'm going to face my fears. And he went up to where he and Eddie would usually walk, and at some point it's a little trace trail, so probably where different animals kind of cross along, so not a very established pathway, and gets out on it, and he thinks it's okay, but suddenly the rocks give way, the land gives way, and it starts to slide towards the edge of the mountainside, and he feels like he can just, time sort of slows down for him, he closes his eyes. And two things happen. With his eyes closed, as though he can see everything around him, as though his eyes are open. And then he can see a figure in light, in the circle of light, that is telling him everything is going to be okay. This is what you have to do. And gives him instructions on how to get his body off of this sliding sort of slab of earth that's heading towards the edge. And he's able to do that. And once he gets to the other side, he looks back and that figure is gone. And I think from that very early age, he recognized that you have to face your fears, right? That you can't let fear overwhelm you, but also kind of knew that there was something out there watching over us, protecting us, guiding us.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's another entry where I think it's with his grandmother when they're going between the mountains on the mountain pass. And of course, you know, you look straight up, a beautiful mountain, you look straight down, not so beautiful. Abyss. Okay. And then I think it's his grandmother. And she says, I need to stop right now. I need to stop. Mm-hmm. And she just stops the car. And then within a few minutes, they hear a crack and there's an avalanche that went right where that car was going to be going. This is where it gets really, really interesting, because I think you have to be a local to know that things happen in threes. And so go ahead and the rest of it.
So Ingo says, she wants to turn around and go the other way. And he says, no, please don't go that way. Please don't go that way. And she's saying, why, you know, we need to go that way to get down. And he just is adamant that something's going to happen. So they don't. And so of course the second one, where if they had proceeded, would have come down on top of them. So they recognize that they have to stay in their car because in Telluride, right? And I think in general, right? Things happen in threes. So they're waiting in the car for the third one and they hear it across the canyon. But by that time, they've stayed in the car and they've run out of gas.
So it's cold.
It's cold. And they have to walk. And you know, really interesting to me, you know, we talked about the Windy Song, the book, The Windy Song.
Yeah.
And I really feel like the character of the aunt is his grandmother, Anna. She's sort of the, you know, if you read about her on Ingo's paternal side, they're Swedish Finns, they're very upstanding community folk. And then on the other side is Anna, who's, you know, from the backwoods in West Virginia. Her family is very large. They've passed away. She's scattered to the winds. The family's scattered to the winds. She's on her own. She finds herself pregnant at 19. She doesn't marry the father. She marries someone else. And she's kind of known around town as kind of the witch, right? So in Telluride, people would come to her to know the sex of their babies or their futures or get their palms read. So two very different types of women, this upstanding Swedish woman and then this sort of like little go-getter. Mm-hmm. And that's Anna.
Yeah, scrappy.
And right, scrappy bootstrapper. She's running the restaurant and the hotel at the Sheridan. And people are coming to her for the sort of like otherworldly advice or insights.
Uh-huh.
That's what she's sort of known for. So she's a little outside of the societal structure. So Ingo is very early exposure to someone like that. And I really feel that character of the aunt from the Windy Song is based on her.
What I also thought was fascinating was his devoted and insistent and stubborn, the tenacity that I don't like my name. This is not my name. It should not be my name. Name me what I used to be called. What did you used to be called? Whoa.
So that's what he's super low. Yeah. So he's saying Rudy Valentino, right? So that he was Rudy Valentino in a previous life. And that's the name that he wanted. And that caused great, great dismay with his parents.
Yeah.
So I want the name I had before. They're like, what is that? And in some respects, in that telling of the story, it's a little about, you know, when we talked about the winnings, there's the character of the priest too, right? Mm-hmm. And the character of the town doctor. So some of that I feel is based on his early childhood experiences. And when this was happening, he's very young. So he's like only two or three, right? When he's telling his parents, I want the name I had before.
Yeah, but also when he finally spouts off about the priest or something, he says something, I'm picturing it from A Christmas Story, when he gets his mouth washed out with soap because of what? Where'd that word come from? Where did you hear that word? And he's, you know, he's not even old enough to have a clue, but boy, he landed one.
Right. So, I mean, so here's this person having these experiences, and he would say probably we all have these experiences to one degree or another. They just get labeled or shunned or ignored.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so with Anna, he found a comrade of sorts that could say, hey, I've experienced these things too. It's okay. We can talk about these things.
He wasn't ostracized or shunned.
No. He was actually very loved because he was the first child and it was 8 years before his sisters would be born. So he had a lot of time with his extended family. And I think because of Anna, who she was, these kinds of things were accepted. And it's not in the book, but another story is around the same time. He tells the story of they were living, you know, next door to his grandparents in a house. And he woke up and had a dream that there was going to be a fire. And he was so sure it was going to happen that he just, like in the, like, don't turn the car around, don't go that way. The same thing. We need to leave the house. There's going to be a fire. And he forced his parents to go, and it turns out that about 3 or 4 hours later, there was a fire that burned the house down.
Wow. Yeah. He had that inner sense that was with him all of his life. I wanted to go back to the Rudy thing, though, because later on he had an illness that they couldn't figure out what the source was. And I believe that's when the psychic gave him some advice.
Yeah. So he just felt like he should have been in New York. He shouldn't be in Telluride. He always felt like New York was where he should be and felt like when he went to New York, he was home. But also as a child, he had these terrible stomach pain, things that would knock him out. Actually, the pain was so blinding and so tremendous, it would knock him out. And so when he got to New York, he thought that these would subside, but they actually only got worse. And his friends, Pauline Winslow and Ray Winslow, were very close to him when one of these things happened. He called them and they called a doctor, and it was a young Korean doctor. And the young Korean doctor said to him, there's nothing wrong with you physically, that this is psychosomatic, whatever you have. There's nothing physically to cause all of this. And he couldn't even comprehend that. And so it was Ray and Pauline who kind of walked him through looking at his going back into a past life regression and looking at that. And that's how when he did that, he could see that he was in a hospital bed in New York City, and he could ultimately see that the person was Rudolph Valentino.
That is astounding. And it's also helpful to know, because other people who have had similar issues and been told, there's nothing wrong, it's all in your head, here, take a pill, make it go away. Mm-hmm. That was different advice. It was like, okay, let's go back and see where this might have originated. And when he did, the illness went away.
Went away. And then all of a sudden, when he could accept that, and what's interesting is he notes is, hey, I'd already met several people who claimed to be Rudy Valentino in a past life, and he would actually meet more people. And the concept of how, of course, everybody wants to be a famous person. If they're going to have a past life, they want to be a famous person. But what does that mean when you tell people, hey, in a past life, I was this person or that person, and how people might look at you if you were to say that?
There's nowhere to go with it unless it has that meaning for you. And with him, I think being in New York, that got him to New York.
It got him to New York and to recognize that his eyesight got much better. All of that pain went away. And then he writes about how he hated coffee. But then afterward, he loved coffee, hated clams. He loved clams. And you know, afterward, he loved really cooking for people, too.
Yeah. And so, okay, so we're in New York. One of the things I find, not only did he had a list of names that anyone would recognize and go, OMG, wow. The place that he was at, it talks about on page 40. During the summer, he held elaborate dinner parties on the roof of his warehouse at 4th and Bowery. There on the sultry Manhattan evenings, we toast a bevy of guests with champagne and fine wine, then eat a gourmet dinner Ingo had prepared, with the Empire State Building, World Trade Center towers lighting our conversation into the wee hours. That's a scene.
it's a wonderful scene. And if you even envision, here is this building on 4th and Bowery, which at the time was known with Bohemians, down and out, right? And he would have people come in elegant ball gowns. And you have to understand, getting up onto the roof was a challenge. It was not like a stairs. It was like a pull-down metal ladder, right? So women in heels having to climb, like, I guess, like the rebar is the best way I could explain this ladder, like a formed out of rebar, climbing up this ladder to get through this hole in the ceiling and then getting out onto the roof.
Did you say like it was like a 4x4 opening?
Yeah, absolutely. So
I was picturing that. Yeah. Okay. And all the plates, right? In the crystal, and the china.
And the crystal. The ladies in evening gowns and stiletto heels, right?
Photos, yeah. Anywhere? Anyone?
Yeah, I don't know. That's Tom Joyce's. Which Tom Joyce is the illustrator on his book, What Will Happen to You When the Soviets Take Over.
And the backstory on that is interesting, too, because apparently that was not the popular name, that if, and then he was insistent when. That's frightening.
Well, he was very insistent on that. And I remember when he wrote it, because, so I was in, I had just started, I was a freshman in high school when he published that. And I actually gave a report on it in my history class in high school.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow. So did you scare everybody?
I don't think I did well on that report.
Well, it's just that thing of he's so good and accurate with a lot of the other things. You're not sure if the attention is to say, pay attention. Don't laugh at this. This could be our future, instead of, oh, it's going to be. A lot of times the psychic stuff is more about, if you want to avoid it, then here are some things that are red flags, literally.
Yes. Well, it's such an interesting book because Tom Joyce, he is right. He explains in his section, it's sort of like a comic book, in that there are so many illustrations. So it's sort of like all these articles, and it's sort of like, it's each kind of profession. So if you're this profession, actor, I don't know, writer, banker, whomever, this is what would happen to you if the Soviets take over. And it approaches it sort of from that perspective, from as a profession, what would be the impact on each?
Little snippets. I think one had to do with a dissident is somebody who disagrees with the whatever the current regime is, where here it's free speech. There it's a dissident, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you're thrown in jail.
So many people have contacted me about this book because of what's sort of going on in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, yeah. I think
as
he's,
well. Yeah.
It's definitely one of those pay attention, sit up, and if you don't want to go down this path, then maybe there's some things you can do immediately.
The book itself is, so Inga self-published that book.
He self-published that. Is it available?
No. I mean, I have all of the original. So before there was digital, right, they would cut, they typeset it, and then they pasted it onto big sheets.
Oh.
Uh-huh. And then would print it from that. So I have that.
Okay. I'm so glad you have all of this stuff, because the works that are available in this book, his artwork is pretty spectacular. And I can understand why he wants it to be experienced personally and not just made into, you know, coffee mugs and napkins.
Yeah. And if you do see his artwork, most of it's from the online, from the 70s or what's at the American Visionary Art Museum. I wanted to show this progression, right? He didn't just become this artist. He progressed, and what I interpreted is he starts in the late 50s. He starts as very sort of that, like, very Salvador Dali-esque, like, mm-hmm, kind of abstract. But even within that, there are elements of the eyes. Like, there's always eyes, even in the early one, the tower one, the eyes. and then you go to the light bringer, and then again, that just the symbol of the eye. But you see this progression. So he finally says, you know what, I'm just not going to make it doing what everybody else is doing in late 50s New York art world. I'm going to start doing what I want to do. And so he starts painting the flowers, but he's not just painting flowers. He's painting what he sees coming off of flowers or things or people. And those are energies or auras. So he's starting, what I see him is he's starting to paint these experiences that he's having.
Well, he's also working it with sound at that point. Steve Halpern is the one that he mentions that he had a collaboration with him for the big movie that was going to come out and be, you know, one of those blockbusters. And so get everybody there, get the orchestra ready. We're going to do this. And this is the score for the movie and it's all done. And then what happened there?
It just didn't. It just didn't. I mean, Steve Halpern said that he went to look for the book and he couldn't even find it in bookstores. He wrote that in Starfire in the mid-1970s. This is where he's still kind of developing the protocols for remote viewing. And I think he's telling us something in Starfire, the movie Starfire. So I think he's saying, hey, there's, look what a real psychic could do.
Yeah. 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 This is the book is about somebody who is a famous rock star or a famous performer who all of a sudden experiences this tremendous psychic awakening and has these abilities. Mm. I think that is so curious because I think in the book, Ingo says, oh, isn't that interesting? Or it's kind of a flippant remark of he wasn't shattered. He wasn't surprised. He wasn't bitter. Mm-hmm. It was just like, yep. Uh-huh. I wonder how much money he got to shut that thing down.
I have no idea. I think it's a really fun book. I think there's a lot of insights into Ingo. And I think the album that he made with Stephen Halpern, Star Children, is pretty funky. I mean, it's this, Stephen Halpern is just starting to get his sea legs with what you would say like new age music.
Yeah.
And this is like a rock disco meets new age album, which is just so out of the world for me to even comprehend, but they made it together and Stevens re-released it.
I want to hear it. I was like, darn, I need to hear this because I've been a fan of Steve Halpern, but I had no idea he did this with Ingo Swann, which is totally different. When you're talking, you know, at that time, what Saturday Night Fever was around and there was just kind of a disco atmosphere and to hear the combination, it's just enticing. I'm curious. and then he says that he would put that on and do his art.
And he would do his art. Yeah, he loved that. He would just dance around to that. So either sort of classical music or high vibrational music. But I think Star Children he loved that. And of course he wrote the lyrics, so.
Yeah. It might have had something to do with it. It was close to home. It was close to home. I know the words, unlike me, who I make up the words as I go along because I can never really hear the exact chorus. And they say, you are listening to that? Well, yeah. Well, you know what it says? I like the tune.
You kind of have to, like, you have to envision you're just 357 in his studio basement, so it's below ground, is really dark. Everything is sort of like, I like to say everything in there is like held, there's actually only one outlet in the whole studio and everything's an extension cord, off an extension cord to that one outlet.
Old school.
And things are held together with duct tape.
Okay. That might have been the fire thing, you know, from years before.
Right.
It might have been.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right. There's art everywhere. There's furniture everywhere. And there he is. He's got a painting propped up on a series of boxes. And he puts on this album. And he's got speakers everywhere. So they're all hooked up together. And it's just, he's blaring that and just dancing around his studio with his paintbrush listening to this. It's just an awesome scene.
The book Stardust Highways. I love the atmosphere and I love the fact that it's so full. And there's always this picture of Ingo. Okay, let's go back to that. The cigar just came to mind. When he was, the real story behind doing the remote viewing, I guess the interview with Hal Puthoff and the real story behind it, because what he makes a point of saying, you don't have to be on any kind of drugs or, you know, psychotropic enhancement to be able to do remote viewing. However, for the introduction, he was so nervous, and this kind of took the edge off. Ha. How many was it? How many? 10 cigars and 4 or 5 different, I can't remember the name of the drink, but...
Oh, the vodka and soda. Yeah, for his reception, right? He was so nervous because he had been doing this work at the ASDR in New York. This is before SRI. He was so excited because the big thing in science, right, is a repeatable experiment.
Yes.
Which he had done with Gertrude Schmeidler when he did in the thermistor. So like a thermos can, they would put a thermometer and seal it in there, and then he would be asked to affect it to make it go up or down, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what led him really to work at ASPR, and Dr. Osis and Dr. Janet Lee Mitchell were doing these out-of-body experiments, so they would play something, and he talks about this in Natural ESP, on a tray, out of sight, in a different room, and then he would be asked, he says, to leave his body and go view it and then sketch what he saw. And he did that, and they had independent judges come and look at what the items were on the tray and then look at his sketches, and they would say, yeah, this is a match. And it was 100% match. And they submitted that to the ASPR publishing committee to publish it in whatever their journal or newsletter. And the publishing committee and the board said, we're not going to publish it because it's too good. It must be fake.
Yeah, they were, I think 2 instances or something. And so it passed and it was great. And they don't like it because if it's 100%, it can't be accurate.
It can't be accurate. So we're not going to publish it. And this is where I tried to really give credit to the, Engel calls them the ladies of ASPR. Viol Mullen, Lucille Kahn, Ruth Hagee Broad, and Vi Bennett, who are really powerful women in their own right, by their own means. You know, Lucille Kahn had worked in Hollywood, close friends with Gloria Swanson. Then she and her husband were the financial backers of Edgar Cayce. Ruth Hagee Broad was a publicist and the writer and the filmmaker. Zelda Suplee, the Earth Mother, nudist, first full frontal nude in Playboy. She ran Reed Erickson's foundation. So these are very strong little, and Beale Mullen, the sculptor and artist who did like Eisenhower's presidential bust mm-hmm. sculpture. So these are very well-connected, well-established women who basically said to the ASPR, sorry, screw you. We're still going to recognize him because what he's done is extraordinary.
Yay.
And we're still going to promote him and we're still going to believe in him. And I really wanted that to come across in the book, that had it not been for these women, Ingo would never really be the Ingo that everybody knows him as, because they believed so much in him and supported him, not financially, but through their connections and through their support and through their belief.
Yeah. Their belief in him. Yeah. And that gave him the, okay, you're not the direction, the doors closed when they would not admit that he was 100% accurate. So then he says, okay, I'm going to take this other meeting with Hal Puthoff, and that goes into the remote viewing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he goes there and he's able to, a magnetometer, right, that they, I don't know, these quark detectors, it's buried under cement. Hal Puthoff, one of the first things he does, takes him to the Hall of Physics at Stanford. He doesn't even know what this piece of machinery is. So not only is he able, and whatever monitoring system it has, it's been like that for several years. Not, it's just like a constant, you know, like small little line. He comes and Hal says, can you affect it? And he does. And all of a sudden it jumps up. And not only does the monitoring equipment, does he affect that, but he draws it. And there's no diagram of this ever anywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just extraordinary what he's done. And that's when I think Hal realizes, wow, we got something here.
Yeah. Yeah. With all of his abilities, did he have any issue with some of the abilities, the remote viewing and all, being weaponized?
I think he, well, I think that's what Starfire, right, is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of his personal, I would just, you know, he speaks through his art, but was it difficult for him in any way to see the direction that it could go?
I think he was asked that quite a bit. And I think his response was sort of like, if we didn't do this for the government, then people wouldn't know what our potentials could be. And his hope was that the world would do something wondrous with these abilities instead of something destructive.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And in terms of getting the support for it, certainly when you have a bankroll and you have permission and you have a staff, right, you have a lot more freedom to explore. You know, if you're stuck in a 9-to-5 grind and you have all sorts of obligations, then there's no outlet. There's no way to just sit back and say, okay, how far can I reach with my mind and what can I affect? Because there's just too many other things that are calling your attention.
He would say, I highly doubt the U.S. government would support this for 20 years if they weren't getting results. So it enabled the development of this, which I think was a double-edged sword for him. Well, it's sort of the price you have to pay to move something along its evolutionary path so that people will know, hey, we have these potentials. They are real. We can unlock them. We can do something with them.
When he was working as a viewer or as a psychic or whatever, what was the most unusual thing in his mind, the weirdest, far out, the totally unexpected, aside from the UFO over the submarine, thing that he discovered?
That he discovered?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Something that even blew him away.
That's a good question. I mean, he's very secretive with all of that. He would always point me to these books, and maybe that's a Gnosis painting, this connection between Mars and Egypt. And even in the early 1970s, he went to Egypt to look at the Sphinx. And he would always say, the world, these things are much older than we are led to believe that they are. And I remember he gave me like Graham Hancock, right? He's got that new series on Netflix.
Right.
He gave me his book. I think he recognized that there was so much more to knowledge that is being kept from us. And if you try to go down these paths to unlocking it, how discredited you could be.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
A way of discouraging you.
Right.
Saying
right. I mean,
Don't go there. Don't go there. You might learn
don't
something.
Go there.
And even worse, you might teach somebody else something too.
Right.
It's okay for you, but don't teach anybody else.
I think he would also say ETs are among us.
Yeah. The supermarket. The supermarket.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have to say, drop that one.
Oh, so that story's in Penetration. So it's in the 70s. He's in LA. He's gone with a friend to the local supermarket to go shopping for a meal. He's going to make lamb chops with orange aspect. And so he's in the produce section, and suddenly he picks up the vibration of something that is not of this world. And he looks up and there's this woman who's in an attire that's totally inappropriate because she must be falling out of her clothes in some way. And he sees her, but what really catches his eye is he sees the twins, and the twins are these two military individuals that he's not quite sure if they're really twins or they just look so much alike that he perceives them as twins. And they were in his encounter when he was taken to the secret base to actually remote view the dark side of the moon. So he's not seen them in a few years, And so he recognizes, okay, here's this woman he's certain is not of this earth. And here are the twins. So clearly she must not be of this earth because they're watching her too. And he decides that it's probably best to get out of the supermarket as quickly as possible. And when he does, he's contacted by that secret figure, Axelrod, who's like interrogating him, like, why were you in that supermarket? As though like he was on some secret mission to
cauliflower.
To encounter this, right. And he's like, all I wanted to do was go shopping, which he doesn't even get because he has to flee the supermarket.
Retreat. Right. But that was his gut. That was his hunch telling him, landslide. Landslide. Yeah. No, right. this is avalanche, whatever it is. It's not going to be good. Okay, so and you allude to that in the book when you say, okay, here's this recipe, and remember when he was in the supermarket. Okay, this is what the rest. This is what he might have made after that encounter.
What he might have made, right? Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's really fascinating for me is that if he would leave, and I went looking for them, details of names of dishes in his books, what other kind of things, if we are looking for them, could we find in those books?
That was what was cool. That was what, well, and you also have the Rudolph Valentino, the secret special spaghetti sauce.
Yes.
Looks good.
Yes. That was, I found that on the list because I think that's what he was known for making, cooking. So I wanted to share that because if that's what really launched Dingo to like really doing these extravaganzas, because I guess Valentino was also known as an exceptional chef too.
Yeah. It makes you hungry.
Sorry.
Like, oh, I wanted to. Well, there's a chicken recipe in there too that has a pasta, a chicken, and some. I can't remember the whole thing. Anyway, it sounded really good. Oh, and I especially he's supposed to be good with everything from Dream Whip to Miracle Whip.
Those are his two loves, right? So he, you know, not mayonnaise. It was Miracle Whip, and not whipped cream. It was Cool Whip.
Cool Whip.
And remembering he only has a hot plate with two coils on it and a toaster oven. And so I think there's one picture of Ingo where he's in his kitchen and you could sort of see it's in the salad section and you see him standing there. It's literally, I don't know, 3 feet by 3 feet. And what he's standing in is when you come up the elevator opens into that space.
Whoa.
So in some respects, it's like the lobby for the elevator in his apartment. It's these wooden boards. And you go, how in the world did he create it? And, you know, that's Bill Ray's quote in there. Like, I can't believe he did this in this space with only these things. And yet he could.
That is, knowing this space, it's like a shoebox.
Yeah, it's like a shoebox. I don't know if you're, like, wherever the salad page is. But if you look at it, it's just enough for him to stand in.
I was at the main dishes. Oh, here I am. Yes, I found it. Yeah, page 128, if you're following along. That's the Poconos chicken salad. That's actually was the one, that rotini pasta with the cook. That's exactly what I was going to, the celery, the grapes, the green onions, I thought was interesting, and cashews with the Miracle Whip. Whoa, that looks like a really cool, interesting recipe.
And you could sort of see it in the book. So that's Sandy Wright, and she was one of the founders of Ions, and she was a frequent visitor at 357. But Ingo also went up to her home in the Poconos too. So that's an ode to her.
Yay. Okay. There's some fun recipes in here, and it's just definitely, you know, you have that sense of him. My Days as a Roman Soldier yogurt, that was a different title for a recipe from his past life. He went back that far.
He did. And he started writing it, and I have it on the website, his, you know, 2000 years of my reincarnation, reincarnation. Mm-hmm. He only really talks about his life as Rudy, but he would in person tell you he went back 2000 years and that the first he went back was as a Roman soldier. And he remembered this recipe. It was like a yogurt with the figs in it. And it was just, he said, to die for is kind of more of a common thing. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to, okay, well, we have Rudy's secret spaghetti sauce stuff, but we have this recipe. And that was the furthest back he went. And he would say, I didn't go any further because what was the point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He might have been an amphibian.
Who knows? Who
knows? Well, I like, you know, the quote in here with his artwork, my works, they are all my children, even the bad ones. And the art throughout is absolutely extraordinary. You've listed them on each page. I like both of the Kismets 1 and Kismet 2. And Daz Smith helped with some of this to help recreate because some were unfinished.
Well, yes, he did some of them. So in one of the paintings, Requiem for Death of Man, if I'm getting the title right. So it's a figure, he's lying on his back, he's in between these big jaws. The unfinished version is, I think, the appetizer section, but the full painting has bees in it. So he cut out the bees for me, and that's what's sort of in that, like, the dandelion salad, that spread page, so he cut out the bees. And then that hopeless dream, he also just kind of reimagined that for me, and then he helped me with that first painting with the punch recipe.
Oh,
the
okay.
Two gods, the gods that play with the little child, which I just thought was, wow, this was such a great painting. I wish I could have seen it.
Wow.
Pretty powerful. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I like the dandelion salad too. I thought, oh, this is perfect timing for spring. Oh,
yes.
And then, but you show the progression, and then the one that you end with, the Lightbringer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's just like, wow, what a punch.
Yeah, so the Lightbringer was his last painting, and it's on display at the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore. He says that an entity dictated to him, so he's doing a portrait of an entity that came to him and said this image, and was very concerned with the details, Inga says, and said that he get all the details right. And that's how he says that painting came to be. But I think he worked on it over the course of at least 5 to 6 years, not more.
Wow.
But definitely his last one. And in some ways, sort of I want to get this right. So in sort of Native American tradition, the star, people from the stars.
Yeah.
He says he's seen depictions of those, and it is very close to this figure in the Lightbringer.
Almost looks like the bird tribe, because there are birds in this photo, or I mean this image page. They're birds. Are they phoenix, or do you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Phoenixes, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, which is rebirth and regeneration and transfiguration, whole nine yards. That's amazing.
Yeah, so it just, when you look at from his beginning to his end, it is such a journey as an artist, as a explorer of human potential, because I think he wove that into his art, too.
Yeah, well, and the eyes, because the eyes in this picture are also outside of the being. There's an eye with the light. And I'm assuming the stars also has specific meaning too, because it's embellished with stars and the birds. And it's like, You see I at the beginning wasn't expecting to see it as it progressed, but the way that you did it was like, oh, each element seems to kind of expand, and as he works with this, and it's very powerful.
Yeah, well, thank you. I wanted to tell the story of him as an artist, as this chef, and as a host, because he was such a congenial person.
He had an inner light, obviously. That's here we go. But he had a way of manifesting it and making it and bringing it through. I actually just turned to this, and it the quote, we are a species exceedingly rich in powers of all kinds. And he says, I aim for a sharing of the sacred, since I see the whole inner and outer universe as an unfolding of it. So as this, you know, this comes out and becomes for more of us a bit more, I think, not illuminated, but apparent, It's sometimes you just, it's like all of a sudden there's a light bulb and you have an idea. It's like, why didn't I think of that before? And then there's a trigger that gives you permission to say, oh, this is it. I have the answer. And I think those things are happening more frequently. And I also think with his art, that's what he's trying to trigger.
I think so too. And I think that's, you know, why it's so important to, I know that he gave paintings away to people, and as they're getting older, I've come across this and people are telling, I always encourage them to try to donate them somewhere so that his art can be experienced by more than just one person in a home.
Yeah, I agree. There's an energy that comes with it. And when we have no idea how powerful the energies that he's talking about, the energies and the forces, when you are in the presence of a master. I have been in the presence of that in a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it goes beyond telling, but it was a three-dimensional, all of a sudden everything goes in the background, the painting comes out, it's Jesus, the painting, and it's in Taos, and they keep it in the dark because the painting lights up and they don't want it to lose that quality. They've had it since the painter donated it because it scared him. He's like, I didn't paint that. but we are influenced by art and artists, and Ingo knows that, and he's still influencing, so he's just having way too much fun.
He probably is. If only we could learn his secret. But I think that's what he's saying is not a secret.
Yeah.
You just need to look and head down the path and experience it.
It's like he had to make that choice with his art. He said, okay, you know, I'm not going to make any money with the art. When the guy down the street can pick it out of the trash and sell it like hotcakes. And he tried it like nobody wanted it. Like, okay, that was the universe going, ha, 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 get the joke now. Go the other direction. That's so frustrating. So, Ellie, I really love what you've done.
Oh, thank you. I just really wanted this to be a joyful book, and I wanted people to have fun, and I wanted people to see this other side of Ingo, and I hope that I've accomplished that for him.
Oh, I think so. And I'm sure you're not done, because you have so much more of his work that can be repurposed.
Yes. And I hear that the Smithsonian in a few years is going to do an exhibit with one of the four paintings they have of Ingo. So
really,
So they have, you know, he donated three, and then the Crow family donated one of Ingo's paintings to them. So the four that they have, and it'll probably be the Highways painting that they have.
Yes.
But I understand it's going to be on display. So maybe, I think 2026, don't hold me to that, but
okay.
Yeah. In the near future, it used to be on display in the museum. That was probably in the late 70s. I don't think it's been on display for a while. It's been in their archives, but it's coming back out.
That's on page 28, right? The Highway.
So it's the one that was in his calendar, 2028.
That's all the numbers at the bottom.
So that's the calendar page.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's the calendar. So that was a calendar that didn't sell, that he threw away, and then they cut out
that
the
That is painting. Just, I mean, I look at it, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is excellent. I'd like a wall. It's transcendent. You know, it's one of those things, it's like, whoa, I can meditate to this. I'll turn on some Steve Halperin. We're going. So yeah, because that's the one he threw away. I didn't realize that. Oh my, I didn't connect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that calendar is probably about 3 feet by 2 feet.
Oh, nice.
So this wasn't just, you know, a little 5x8 or 8x10 thing this guy put in the frame. So.
No, what I get is when Ingo does stuff, he does it big.
Yeah,
he's into big. because if you can't get it, then you're lost. Okay.
The Millennium painting, which is on display at the ABM, the American Visionary Art Museum, It's three panels, and each panel is 8 by 10 feet.
Yeah, that's big.
Yeah. That's huge. Even that light, the light bringer, I want to say, I don't have the dimensions, but at least 7 or 8 feet long.
Wow.
4 or 5 feet tall. Yeah. They're really big. So to your point, yes, everything was big.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I get. But I get there's a purpose, because the impact then is, I mean, you're talking bowling ball. You know, this isn't just a baseball bat knock upside the head. This is like wham, wham. So, okay. Well, I appreciate all the work that you've done, and I like the pictures in the back. Your son contributed the photos, and there's some beautiful, beautiful photos in there. I like the German Shepherd getting a credit for getting you up and pointing you to the room and saying, okay, now you're on to work. I'll go back to bed.
I'm going back to sleep. My job's done. Have fun.
And I thought that was really good. The taskmaster.
Yeah. No, why? It's so unfair. Where are you going? I'm going back to bed. That's the conversation. Okay.
Like, you're not going to sit beside me as I do my work? Nope, done.
And I give my son a lot of credit. He's a freshman in college now. And he was home on winter break. And I was like, okay, we need to photograph these things. And, you know, the, oh, mom, with the eye roll, right? And But he did it, and I think he did an amazing job. And I'm just so grateful, because I feel like he captured the essences of Ingo's dishware and glassware. I mean, he has tons and tons of it, because he did. He just had these very elaborate dinner parties with china and glass from the 20s to the 50s glassware. So.
Limoges, yeah,
and that was, right. Yeah.
There's more detail on that, and the types of glasses that are used for different types of wine or for different beverages, and the napkins, and the placement of the guests. I mean, there's a lot of information in here that is, you know, specifically how to do a dinner party. And the photos where he does take the pictures of the glasses and then compares it, possibly there'll be a flower in a glass, and then Ingo's painting of a flower in a glass. I thought there was nice juxtaposition with the art and the photos.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to say, hey, this was a man, when he did something, he did it. I mean, he really did it. He was exceptional in anything. There was no halfway with Ingo.
Well, I certainly had no idea what to expect with a recipe book, but then going into little things like the brief history of the Egyptians, where they would gather around a reed mat, and once assembled, the food would be set in a large dish in the middle. They'd take turns eating in the bowl. Once everyone was finished, new foods would be introduced. There's also a little snippet there on why they changed from wood plates that had bugs and disease to plates that were actually furnished, either pottery or glazed. I'm like, oh, that's almost too much information.
And I did that for Ingo, because he loved the history of things. So if you read his books, he, especially like The Secrets of Power, Wisdom, or Reality Boxes, he spends a lot of time on definitions and histories, because those were very important to him, and because you have to understand the context where something comes from. I encourage everybody to, you know, get out there and try. That's what Ingo said, get out there and experience life, go live, and know that we are so much more than what we are taught.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ellie. Is there anything else you want to add? I mean, the website is wonderful site. You've got the artwork there, also other information about Ingo. I love the website as well, because there's a ton of information most people don't include on the website, and his pictures.
His pictures are there. There are free downloads there in the BioMind Superpowers section. It's a download of everything that was on that website. So when he had his own website, it was BioMind Superpowers, and everything he had on there is available as a PDF. On that section of the website, there's some unfinished manuscripts. There's a little bit on astrology. There are lots of videos. There are lots of other people's videos. Hopefully it's a good resource and encourage people if they're interested in Ingo. It kind of gives a broad brush picture of who he was across the spectrum of who he was.
One thing I appreciated was he wanted everybody to have access to the information. When I first discovered him, the book Penetration was on his website and I downloaded it. And I just thought that was a great way, you know, to share the information and also encourage other people who might have that kind of talent to know there was a resource.
Yeah, and he was always very, very gracious to in sharing information, saying, hey, I didn't do this alone, right? This development of the protocols of remote viewing, it wasn't just me. There's a history of what traveling clairvoyance, but there was also this depth of, sense depth of people, and I'm grateful to them. And so on the website too, I try to link to all of their archives as well, so that people know that you can explore, and certainly across the U.S., many universities have libraries with people's archives, and I hope people take advantage of that too. I mean, we've definitely tried to support the University of West Georgia. We have the Ingo Swann Research Fellowship, which is every other year, but we've also created an endowment, an acquisition endowment for them to continue to collect, and they are aggressively doing that. And so their archives of human potential, human consciousness studies continues to grow, and I hope people take advantage of what these universities, I know even across the globe, are doing to collect this information as well. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I'll put links in the description for the show. So if you're listening and you want to find out more, the links will be there. You can also go to ingoswan.com to check out all of Ingo's work, or the book Stardust Highways, Ingo Swann's Art of Entertaining. This is all available through Amazon or your favorite bookseller, wherever you buy books. And my guest, Ellie Flippin, Ingo's niece, who has all the inside scoop that maybe she hasn't told everything just quite yet.
Oh, stay tuned. There's a lot more.
Hypnotic regression next, right?
Well, if you want to know, Clay Baxter's archives are at the University of West Georgia, and he was the CIA's hypno-interrogation specialist. So.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Hypno-interrogation specialist. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. So.
More uncovered gold coming next.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. Sounds good. Thank you. Okay.